Welcome to the Cleveland Public Library's Sports Research Center and our conversation with Harrison Dillard, which was recorded on September 13th, 2012, only a few months before he celebrated his 90th birthday. He was born on July 8th, 1923. Mr. Dillard is acclaimed as one of the two greatest athletes ever to come out of Cleveland, the other being Jesse Owens. They both were Olympic track champions. He graduated from East Tech High School in Cleveland in 1941 and entered Baldwin Wallace College to run track. His college career was interrupted by World War II. He was drafted into the Army and served in the infantry in the front lines in Italy. After the war, he returned to Baldwin Wallace College to earn his degree and go on to Olympic glory. In the 1948 Olympics in London, he won gold medals in the 100 meters and the 4x100 relay. In the 1952 Olympics in Helsinki, Finland, he won the 110-meter hurdles and the 4x100 relay. He continued to compete through the mid-50s, and in 1955, he won the Sullivan Award, symbolic of the nation's Outstanding Amateur Athlete of the Year. Later, he worked for the Cleveland Indians, radio station WERE, and for many years, the Cleveland Board of Education. It's our pleasure to introduce you to Harrison Dillard, a true Cleveland sports icon. 89 years old, Harrison.
Right.
Here we are in September of 2012, and when will you turn 90?
July 8th, next
year. Okay,
so
you just turned 89. Would you reflect back on your days at East Tech? First of all, tell me, back then, East Tech was an integrated high school, right? You had a lot of blacks, whites. What was the ratio, as you recall?
Well, as I remember, it was probably... maybe 80-20 white back in those days.
Yeah.
Of course, the students were eligible from anywhere on the east side.
Oh, they were.
Wanted a technical education.
Yeah.
You went to East Tech, mm-hmm. lived on the west side, you went to West Tech.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How about, did they recruit kids from the star athletes from other school areas?
Yeah, it was, and thinking back, there was recruitment there.
Yeah.
Rawlings Junior High School, yeah. Fairmont,
yeah.
and Kennard, I think, were like the three feeder schools to East Tech. And that's where the bulk of the East Tech track teams came from.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Later on, when John Broski had those great basketball teams at East Tech,
mm-hmm.
all those kids didn't go there just by accident. They
no.
weren't born in the neighborhood.
No.
Just. Okay, now, were those happy days for you?
Oh, yeah, they were good days. We didn't have anything, but we didn't know that.
Yeah.
So we had a good life.
Who was your track coach?
My track coach was Ivan Green.
Ivan Green, a famous name.
Yeah, very big in high school track in the
yes.
state of Ohio.
And what made him such a good coach?
Well,
he was a good recruiter.
Well, both.
Yeah.
He was that, but he also he knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
And he knew how to get it out of 15, 16, 17 year olds.
Yeah.
And I think that takes a particular knack. And he had that. Plus, he always had your back if you anything happened.
Yeah.
You got any kind of trouble or problems.
Yeah.
He was always there to offer advice, and keeping in mind that this is the late 30s, early 40s, I remember going to the state high school track championships in 1940, I guess, and how we were refused admission to a hotel, Chittenden Hotel in
really?
Downtown Columbus.
Really?
And Ivan Green just stole. He pitched a fit.
Really?
And we got in.
Really?
He got us in.
Were you considered a local superstar here? When you were in high school, were you noticed here?
As a senior, perhaps.
Right.
There was some degree of notice and appreciation. Because I won the city championship and I won the state championship as a senior.
Did the papers here, there were at least three, maybe more.
Yeah, Press, News, and Plain Dealer.
Okay, did they Did they do much with high school track back in those days? Like, did you have a lot of clippings?
Yeah, I remember particular Jack Clouser.
Oh, yeah.
From the press, and Chuck Heaton from PD. They did several stories on me, as I recall. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then we come to your college days.
Yeah.
I heard you say once that you were recruited by Ohio State, and you seemed to be headed for Ohio State. Would you tell us that story?
Yeah, I was actually headed to Ohio State. I had been contacted by several other colleges. Universities offered help, job, scholarship, partial scholarships, that type of thing, including, as I remember, Michigan State and was it with Kent, I think, maybe.
Yeah.
But anyway, I had made up my mind that I would go to Ohio State because my idol, Jesse Owens, was going to go there.
Uh-huh.
And
He went there. He, yeah.
Yeah, he got, of course, that was Jesse's
matter.
So I said, well, I want to go where Jesse goes. I've been to Columbus a couple of times.
Did you know Jesse well in those days?
I didn't know him well, but I knew him.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I dated a niece of his a couple of times.
Really?
Yeah. But anyway.
How close to, what neighborhood did you grow up in? Anywhere near where Jesse Owens grew up?
Not really. I grew up around East 55th Street. Generally, I lived actually on East 63rd Street.
Oh, yeah.
Jesse grew up, I guess it was, 86th Street, farther east and a little farther north. But I wound up, when I decided that I was going to Ohio State, I got cold feet at the last minute.
Did you?
After all, it was 140 miles. And I thought that was just a little too far from home to be going to stay for, extended periods. So I told my mother that I changed my mind. And I had talked with Eddie Finnegan, who, when he found out that I was going to Ohio State, he just wished me well and said, well, if you change your mind, give me a call. So about 2 weeks before I was supposed to go to Columbus, I changed my mind.
And Eddie Finnegan, of course, was the Baldwin-Wallace coach.
Yeah, football and track. And not noted for his skill or abilities at coaching track at that time, but he was a quick learner, fast learner.
Really?
And he did promise me that if you're good enough, you come to Baldwin-Wallace, we'll see that you get to all the national competitions.
Really?
And it turned out that he was a man of his word. As I say, he's a quick learner. He and I, we learned to run the hurdles together almost, might say.
Oh, that's good. Now, you got out of East Tech. Let's get the chronological order right.
Yeah.
You graduated from East Tech what year?
1941.
And then now, were you out of Baldwin-Wallace by 1948 when you ran in your first Olympics?
No. I graduated from East Tech 41.
Yeah.
Immediately that fall, went to Baldwin-Wallace and stayed there until 1943.
Uh-huh.
I was a member of the enlisted reserve, and in 1943, April, were called to active duty. And another interesting sidelight, Baldwin-Wallace at that particular time had never won the Ohio Conference in track and field. That was one of Eddie's hopes and aspirations, one of his goals, that he wanted to coach a champion in the Ohio Conference, and he wanted to coach a national champion. So we were able to win that Ohio Conference in 1943. Uh-huh. Actually, now we were in the military. We'd been drafted. We'd been called to active duty. Where were we? Somewhere up toward Toledo, I forget the name of the camp right now. But anyway, that's where we were.
When you say we?
Other guys were on that Baldwin-Wallace track team at that time, 1943.
Uh-huh.
And Eddie prevailed on the commanding officer to grant us weekend passes.
Really?
So we came back and ran and won the Ohio Athletic Conference track field championship, then went, you know, back into the military.
Oh, that's great. And then what did you do? How long were you in?
I was in a total of 32 months.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, and I spent, 16 months overseas, I guess.
Where?
The overseas time was spent all of it in Italy. I was in the 92nd Infantry Division, the Buffalo Soldiers.
Oh.
That was an all-black division.
Really?
And we spent, I think, seven months and a couple of weeks in combat.
Really?
In Italy, you know, going from the south all the way up,
yeah,
up north. And, well...
Can you recall any of your battles? Were you ever shot at? Were you ever wounded?
I was never wounded, yeah, thank goodness. shot at, yeah.
Really?
I remember one incident that involved the Nisi, you know, the Japanese soldiers, who I guess had, their parents were in, what, internment camps?
Oh, yes, yeah.
I guess President Roosevelt, mm-hmm, had put them out there.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, these guys, would be near the end of the war, would have been 1945, probably March, April, sometime of that, 1945.
Mm-hmm.
And our 92nd Infantry, my regiment, mm-hmm, I guess 370th Regiment, was down in a valley, kind of, and up on the sides of the mountains. We could see these Japanese American soldiers,
really,
going through mortar fire, artillery,
really,
fire, machine gun fire, and one of these guys are crazy.
Gee.
That they weren't didn't seem to be trying to find shelter of any kind. They just kept marching, just zigzagging, going up that mountain and going forward, going north, and we just marveled at what they did. Their actions. I believe they were probably incurred the most casualties of any American,
wow,
group in at that particular time, and they were probably also the most decorated group because,
really,
of their. They had something to prove,
uh-huh,
that they were good and loyal Americans, and obviously excellent fighting men.
Wow.
But that was one of the things I remember most vividly about my service in Italy. I remember one other incident. I remember happening in a farmhouse. We would, you'd be in the field or someplace moving. But whenever farmhouses offered shelter, you took advantage of them.
Uh-huh.
And they had indoor toilet facilities.
Yeah.
And so I remember once going into one, and just at that time, the Germans decided, I guess, to do a little artillery fire.
No. Oh, gee.
Boy, these artillery shells were going around that farmhouse.
Gee.
That was not a pleasant memory.
Oh, boy. So, how was your trip to Italy? Yes. Later on, you probably ran in track meets in Italy, but we'll come to that a little later.
Uh-huh.
So you got out of the service.
Well, I ran in the service.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, because after the war ended, I think it was May the 8th, 1945, mm-hmm, if memory serves me correctly, the Germans surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember they, we'd beaten them. They mm-hmm surrendered. So, but they didn't come straggling in. They cleaned up as best they could.
Right.
And these guys, hundreds, probably a few thousand of them, I guess, surrendered to some little city outside of Viareggio, Italy. They came in, they got in formation and actually paraded, marched in,
really,
even to surrender. And our commanding officers that, you know, sent us out there to watch them surrender, I guess. And so we saw them surrender. But they were good soldiers, but they ran out of munitions. They didn't have any oil and gas. And bullet, I saw wooden bullets even.
You're kidding.
Yeah, that they had used those last few weeks in the war.
Really? So you then, of course, the war in Europe is over at that point.
Yeah.
But you remained in the service running?
Yeah, what happened was that once the war ended, we were assigned initially to just, you know, guarding prisoners, German prisoners. One day, a couple of weeks after the war ended, a non-commissioned officer, a corporal, came around from headquarters and posted a sign that any athletes interested in trying out for baseball, basketball, I guess, what was it, football and track, I think those four sports, just contact your company commanders and get permission and sign up down at headquarters. So it turned out that the this non-commissioned officer was named Roscoe Brown. This long before, of course, Roscoe Lee Brown, who became a very prominent actor in Broadway and movies later on.
This was him?
Yeah, this was
really?
that Roscoe Brown. He was a non-commissioned officer that came around. Incidentally, Roscoe was also a runner himself.
Really?
So we were on track team together. Roscoe ran 800 meters. In fact, I think Roscoe became a national champion at either 800 or 1500 meters later on, you know, a few years later. But we ran all over Italy, and we were eventually, they had what became known as the GI Olympics. This would pit the Mediterranean theater against the European theater.
Really?
So we had a couple of Big Ten athletes on our squad. We had a couple of other good athletes, let's put it that way. And when we went up to Frankfurt, Germany, this is where they held that particular competition. And I remember it was the first airplane flight for most of us. We'd never been on a plane before. And when we got over the Alps, a big electrical rain thunderstorm hit. We were in a plane that had been used to carry paratroopers, so there were no seats as such, just these benches along each side of the fuselage. In the middle, it was a cargo plane, converted to a cargo plane. So it had whatever they were shipping up to Germany with us. It was, in chains and ropes and all that, covered with canvas in a way. There in the center of the fuselage, well, we hit this storm, this electrical storm, and as I mentioned, none of us, must have been 20-25 of us, I guess, we had never flown before, never been in a plane, and when that plane hit the storm and started to pitch back and forth, up and down and twisting, and oh God, we were scared.
Oh,
you know the expression. So, we finally it was over and we did get there and we landed in Frankfurt and a day or two later we began these GI Olympics between the Mediterranean theater and the European theater. And I had been running. 3-4 events, five because I run relays sometimes. But I usually would run about 4 events, the high and low hurdles, 100 and 200. And maybe a relay, but up there, I remember I ran, I think only 4 events. I think I won four first places. And the 100, and what? No, I won 200 in the high hurdles and what else? Maybe a couple of relays, I think I won. Anyway, I won four first places. And Stars and Stripes, the the GI newspaper, military newspaper, they had their reporters there. And there was a general there at those competitions.
Yeah?
Yeah. A fellow that, you know, everybody knows. Who was it? George Marshall.
No kidding.
Portrayed him later on. But George Patton was there with that shiny helmet liner on. Uh-huh. Had those riding pants on and the two bone-handled pistols and all that. He was there. Interesting sidelight. General Patton himself had been an Olympic athlete back, I think it was 1912, if my memory serves correctly, having I read that.
Really?
That he'd been, what did he do? Oh, the equestrian events.
Okay.
He competed in Stockholm, 1912. But anyway, he was there.
Okay.
And when the competition ended, the Stars and Stripes reporters, of course, interviewed mm-hmm. General Patton. And
yeah.
They asked him what he thought of this athlete, this PFC from the Mediterranean Theater. And he said, best GD athlete I've ever seen.
You really? Oh, that is good. So then you get out, and what's your return to BW, huh?
Yeah, I was discharged early January 1946 after some 32 months in the service. And immediately, within a matter of weeks, I was back in school at BW. And I ran some of the indoor competitions. I guess they didn't think I could be ready at having just been discharged from the military, but there were some competitions I did enter. And there I began a streak of wins that, I don't know, must have got the 40-something, I guess,
really?
Before I lost the race, and I don't remember who beat me.
More than 40 wins in a row.
Yeah. I had a couple of streaks like that. I had one that began in what, I'm getting ahead a little bit now, but I think it ran from, 46 to 47, I think.
Really?
Where I won 82 in a row. And that stood for probably 40 years or more before anybody broke that streak. But anyway, I'm back at Baldwin Wallace, and my coach Eddie Finnegan had this dream of mm-hmm. coaching national champion.
Uh-huh.
So in 1946, I won my first national collegiate championships, high and low hurdles. And I guess I won all my competitions, as I remember. And of course, Eddie was just elated, as was I, naturally, uh-huh. that I was able to win uh-huh. national championships my first year mm-hmm. back.
So 46, and did you run again in 47?
Yeah, I continued. I won again both national collegiate titles. Outdoors. Mm-hmm. Back then they didn't have indoor championships. But I won 120 highs, 220 yard lows, and began that running on that circuit in the East. Philadelphia, there were two meets in Boston, about three, I think, in New York. The New York Athletic Club, the National AAU, mm-hmm. and the Millrose Games. Did I mention Philadelphia?
Philadelphia.
And of course, there were the Cleveland Knights of Columbus.
Sure. Now, those are indoors.
Yeah, those are all indoors. So I won those competitions beginning, I guess, for the most part, 46 and 47. And I won most of them all the way through 1956, which was the year that I retired. I think in, Cleveland, mm-hmm. I won my first Cleveland competition in the KSC in 1943 before I went into the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back after being discharged from the service, and I guess I won them from 46 through 56.
Really?
That's about a dozen.
The KSC track meet?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's about 12 straight, competitions
wow.
at KSC. And as I said, at the Philadelphia Inquirer games, I think I won 9 consecutive years there.
Wow.
I think I won until the, from 1947 through 55 maybe, when they discontinued that meet. And in the Millrose, I won 9 consecutive years.
Wow.
In the indoor national championships, I won 7 consecutive championships. Then I think I'd beaten one, then I came back and won another to make a total of 8, which might still be a record, I think, for indoor hurdles championships.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Chicago, yeah.
Were all of these hurdles that you were winning?
These were hurdles, yeah.
Yeah.
In Chicago, Chicago Daily News at that time sponsored a relays event.
Mm-hmm.
And I won 10 consecutive years there.
Wow.
So
wow.
I had a string of, you know, 5 or 6 different cities where I won 9 or 10 consecutive mm-hmm. years.
Now,
indoors.
So, okay, those are all indoors.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's get to 48 Olympics.
48 Olympics.
Now, you were, your specialty was the hurdles. And you were the overwhelming favorite to win the hurdles.
That's right.
So what happened?
Well, I was the world record holder in the 120-yard high hurdle.
Uh-huh.
Of course, in the Olympic Games, you know, you're on the metric distance, 110 mm-hmm. meters, which is approximately the same distance.
Yeah.
But anyway, when on the qualifying day, first of all, let me say that I ran 100 meters in 1948 on a Friday evening,
uh-huh.
The qualifiers for the 100 meters, and I placed 3rd behind Barney Ewell and Mel Patton.
Oh, yeah.
So as the 3rd qualifier, uh-huh. I was actually on the Olympic team,
uh-huh.
and that meant probably I would also run on the 4x100 meter relay
team.
But that was on a Friday night. So the next night, next afternoon or evening, Saturday, I ran the hurdles, in which I was a world record holder. Well, again,
mm-hmm.
it's an event in which I have to finish, just no worse than 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be on the Olympic team and
mm-hmm.
in my favorite event. So as fate would have it, that day, it wasn't my day. And I guess that's maybe part of the beauty, or if not
wow.
the beauty, certainly the uncertainty and the attraction of sport. You never know what's going to happen on any given day. So on that day, in an event in which I held a world record,
yeah.
I didn't even qualify.
Wow.
I finished, dead last.
Really?
I hit hurdle after hurdle. And I think I only cleared maybe 7, because I think I finished at the 8th hurdle, so completely off stride and out
really?
Of balance and off rhythm that I didn't even try to negotiate the final 2 hurdles. So
this was one race.
That was one race.
One race determined who went to the Olympics in that event.
Right.
Wow.
And so I didn't go on the hurdles, but luckily the day before I'd run the sprint, so I went as the number 3 American sprinter.
The world was shocked when you failed to qualify.
Yeah, because that was supposed to be one of the sure things.
Yes.
That Dillard would win the 110 meter hurdles for the United States.
So did an American wind up winning the hurdles?
Yeah, we wound up getting the first 3.
Really?
Bill Porter
uh-huh.
from Northwestern won it. And let's see if I can. I don't know what I recall the other 2 guys' names, but anyway, we ran 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
So my missing it showed how strong we were that particular
yeah.
time, in that event. So we won it anyway, and I go to London
mm-hmm.
in 1948, 64 years ago, as the number 3 American sprinter.
Gee. And you won the gold medal.
Yeah. Yeah, I won my first of 4.
Uh-huh.
Because I ran on that winning 4x100 meter
yes.
relay team as well. But and the story in the 100 meters, you know, you go through your trials and you had, I guess, your qualifying heats and quarterfinal heats and semifinals, the three heats. And in the final, as I say, I'm regarded as the number three American sprinter behind Mill Patton and Barney Ewell. Each of whom that year had run 10.2 for the 100 meters, which at that time was the world record. But I won all of my heats, my three heats, including the semifinal that Barney was in, and I beat him in the semifinal. So in the final, and there were only six finalists back then instead of the eight that they run nowadays, in that final, I drew the sixth lane, which is right up against the stands.
Is that good or bad?
Generally, you don't want to be there. You don't like it, well, for two reasons. First of all, just because it's there, you know, you feel like you're there's a brick wall right next to
really?
You.
Really?
But also, keep in mind, this was before automatic timing was in effect. It became put into effect in those particular games, 1948. But oftentimes in other meets where they didn't have that kind of timing, you know, the judges simply were up on the steps or the stairs looking down. And there was always the fear that if you were in lane one or lane six, that with their vision, they might tend to overlook the guy who's in one or six. So it's better you want to be in, you know, two, three, four, preferably somewhere in the middle of the track. But fortunately, in 1948, the Omega Company, that was the official timer for the Olympic Games, actually had been since, the 1932 Games in Los Angeles. They had developed this photoelectrical system that time gave each athlete's time, and also you could see very clearly, definitely, where he finished, because it stopped the course when the first athlete hit the tape or the finish line, and you could see where every athlete was behind him. So that system was used in 1948 for the first time, and Omega had developed that particular system. So I won that race. I thought I won it. I remember going through the tape. I think, as I recall, I didn't normally try to break the tape with your chest, but as I remember, my arm hit the tape first. I think it was my right arm. At the same time, I could see down to my left, somewhere down there, was another white jersey. Somebody in the United States jacket. He's doing the same thing. He's going into the tape. Well, I thought I'd won. I was pretty sure I'd won. But once we get through the tape, it turned out that guy down there was Barney Ewell, my teammate and roommate. Well, Barney begins to jump up and down and, you know, dance. And
he thought he won.
He thought he won. So the fellow who was next to him, he was in lane two? So the fellow in lane three was Lloyd LaBeach from Panama, another terrific sprinter who had beaten Patton and Ewell a time or two himself. So when Barney Ewell starts to jump up and down and celebrate, LaBeach, who originally, he's born Jamaica, but he represented Panama, I guess he had dual citizenship. He represented Panama in the games. So when Barney starts to dance and jump up and down and celebrate, LaBeach says, no, man, you don't win, Bones win.
Bones, that was your nickname.
As I say, I thought I'd won. I was pretty sure, but Omega's system, it proved. I'd actually won the race by 12, 16 inches.
Really?
So I got my first gold medal, and Barney, who was my teammate, roommate and a good friend. Yeah. We were great buddies.
How did he take it?
Well, he congratulated me, gave a good hug. In fact, I had a picture of him, him and I, you know, arm in arm later on after the race.
It had to be heartbreaking, though.
Yeah, he was obviously greatly disappointed because I think Barney finished second in the 200 meters as well.
By the way, Omega, is that an Omega watch you have on?
Yeah.
I recognize that. Yes.
Yeah, that's the watch that Omega gave me, and this is I don't know how many of these they made.
When did they give that to you?
I just got that one. When did I get that? A year ago. Probably.
It's a beautiful watch.
Yeah. And I think it was I think it's a 991, so I don't know how many of them they made.
Well,
but it has the Olympic rings in it. That's
okay. What was the occasion that they gave that to you?
Well,
all these years later.
When in 1948, I guess, they were rather, and 212, this past Olympic Games. I heard from them probably in 2011, that they wanted to use photographs from the 48 games, that finish.
Gee.
And so they offered a watch. So we got into negotiations. And
really? You would not have been able to accept that watch in
1948.
No.
Unless it was a prize, you know, for the race itself. But anyway.
Well, now today, a gold medal winner gets what? Americans get what?
$25,000. For
and
gold
you,
medal.
You got what for your gold medal in 48?
Nice going.
You got a pat on the back. No. Oh.
Omega, they not only the watch I got this time, but my entire family, my daughter and three grandchildren. My wife passed almost 3 years ago. Otherwise, she would have been there too.
Yeah.
But we all were able to go courtesy of the Omega Watch Company.
Isn't that nice? So you win your two gold medals in 1948.
Mm-hmm.
You went over there on a boat, I imagine.
Yeah, we went on the SS America.
Okay, did you ever get seasick, anything like that?
No. I got seasick during the military.
Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear
that.
When
I went over on a Liberty ship,
yeah,
which was about probably one quarter as big as the SS America. But no, the SS America was great.
Okay. So you come back.
Come back.
Heroes reception for you?
Not really.
No?
There was, I don't know, a luncheon or a dinner. Now I've forgotten now. It's so long ago. But that was the extent of it, as I remember.
A luncheon where? Here in Cleveland?
In downtown.
Or a dinner,
Downtown Cleveland.
And that was all?
Yeah.
No ticker tape parade?
No ticker tape, no parade, nothing like that.
But,
And of course, I went back to school.
Oh, you did?
Because I hadn't quite finished my work at Baldwin Wallace. I didn't graduate, actually, until the next quarter of January 1949.
Okay. So then what did you do?
Well, I kept running.
Yeah. But now, did you have to go to work, or?
I had to go to work because back then, of course, as compared to today, when athletes who really want to run, that can be their main job. But back then, you had to have a job. And
those pesky amateurism rules.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I had the job I had, Bill Veeck hired me in 1949.
Did he?
To work in the Indians' public relations department. So who was Marsh Samuel and Nate Wallach?
Sure.
Were there at that particular time. And I worked with them in the Indians' PR department from 1949, So Frank Lane fired everybody in 1958, I think.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
He got you, too.
He got me, too.
Oh, gee. Oh. Oh.
Well, that was an interesting period. The Indians, of course, they had good teams then. They couldn't beat the Yankees except in 54.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, they were competitive, year in, year out. In 54, they lost the four straight to the Giants.
Sure.
And I had been contacted by the State Department, United States State Department, and immediately after the 1954 World Series ended, I embarked on a goodwill tour, I guess you would call it, of South and Central America and the West Indies. And
this was for baseball, right?
No, this is for the United States, for the State Department.
Oh, okay.
I got, well, you know, the Indians, they let me go. They didn't, try to stop me. In fact, they encouraged me to go.
Really?
So I went. I think I left, as I say, immediately after the World Series, so it was probably the second week in October. And I was gone for 93 days, as I recall.
Wow.
I didn't get back until, I think, the next January.
Really?
All over the West Indies and South and Central America. You know, Brazil, Argentina, Bolivia, Chile, all.
Really?
A lot of countries down there.
In all your travels, though, we have jumped ahead. We haven't covered the 52 Olympics.
Well,
can we backtrack a couple years?
Well, we're getting to them.
Okay.
This is before the 50. Well, that's right. This is 54. So, we're going to have to
backtrack just a bit.
Talk about the 52 games.
Where you finally won your hurdles.
Yeah. I had elected, because I'm out of school now.
Yeah.
I'm still running the meets. By then, Hank Greenberg is the general manager for the Indians baseball club. Novaka's still there at that time. No, that's when Vex sold the team. Nate Dolan and Harry Small. I forget the other.
Well, Greenberg was still the general manager.
General manager. Yeah. So, but anyway.
And but that was your income.
That was my
job. Right.
So. I went to Hank and I asked him if I could have a few weeks off so I could go to the West Coast to Los Angeles and train and run two or three competitions and qualify for the Olympic team.
Yeah.
So Hank said, sure, go ahead.
And did he keep you on the payroll for that?
Yes, stayed on the payroll.
Very good.
And I don't know whether it was right or not back then, but anyway.
You're flirting with danger back there.
But he said, you know, go ahead. And say, if you need the money, we'll send it to you. If not, we'll be here when you get back. So that's what I did. I think I went to California and stayed 3 days, three weeks, and ran, I think, in about three meets out there and found out that I still had it.
Yeah.
And qualified for the United States Olympic team in the 110-meter hurdles.
Now, at that time, were you getting a little old for...
I was 29. I turned 29 that summer.
Well, okay, then you weren't too old, but you were...
I was getting there.
This was your last hurrah.
Yeah, I was getting there. And I was lucky and fortunate. Of course, I worked hard to get in shape. And
were you married then?
No, this was, I met my wife that winter, 52 in December. I met the lady who was to become my wife, Joy. She was Jamaican. She had been born, raised in Jamaica. And we were married all total, almost 54 years before she passed in 2009.
Yeah.
But anyway, getting back to the Olympic Games, in 52, my toughest competition was going to be a fellow named Jack Davis. Jack was from Southern Cal. In fact, we competed against each other for, I don't know, three, four, maybe 5 years. And I think Jack beat me twice during that period. I beat him maybe, 12, 14 times. But he was good enough that if I weren't at my best, he could beat me, and he did beat me twice. Anyway, when we got to Helsinki, both went through our trials.
That was the 52 Olympics. We were in
Olympic
Helsinki.
52 Olympic Games in Helsinki. Yeah. And both of us won all our heats, and so we were going to hook up again in the finals. And I forget the lane assignments there, but I think he and I were in lanes next to each other, if I remember correctly. Anyway, Jack was big. See, Jack was 6'3" and weighed probably close to 190 pounds. He was a big man. At that time, I was 5'10". Mm-hmm. What did I weigh then? I think I weighed 159, 160 pounds. And I had gained weight in the ensuing 4 years, mm-hmm. between 48 and 52. But still a little guy, you know, compared to him. So that and when you run against bigger guys like that in hurdles, the arms swing, of course. And if they swing and you happen to be there when they swing, you know, you get hit and knock you off stride and destroy your rhythm. But fortunately, none of that happened. Being smaller, I was also quicker because I had less weight to, you know, start from scratch to get underway. So I got the good start again and got out in front and said, well, now if I can just negotiate these hurdles, I'll win this race, and which I was doing. And then I could hear Jack, he's grunting in the background. And he was coming. And finally I saw that big foot came up there close enough that I could see it, you know, with peripheral vision. And then I think it was...
Was he gaining on you?
He was gaining, which I knew he would, which he always did. In the races, those races that I beat him, he always came at the end. Mm-hmm. And he was coming in this race, too. But I think I heard the bang. I think he hit the, I think it was the ninth hurdle.
Yeah.
And I knew it was him. Uh-huh. And, but I didn't hit it. I was sitting on him perfectly. And I slid over the ninth and tenth and started toward the tape. Well, I knew that by then, the race is mine, because there's no way that he could catch me in a little runoff between the last hurdle and the tape. So he wound up, actually, he finished second, a good second, I suppose less than a yard behind me, but I had, that was like vindication.
Okay.
I had won the 110-meter hurdles, and again, I ran on that 4x100-meter relay team. Uh-huh. So after that, I had 4 gold medals.
Okay. Did you run in the 100 meters again?
No, I didn't run the 100 meters. I elected not to try the 100. It would have been just too much to try it. As it stands now, I guess I'm the only athlete who has ever won the 100 and the 110-meter hurdles.
Wow.
The two short races in the Olympic Games.
James.
No other athlete has, well, they've ever even tried that combination before. It took me 2 Olympics to
James.
Do it.
Now, after your Olympic stardom, how did that affect your life?
Well, obviously, I was working with the Indians, of course, you know, by then. And said I stayed with them until my career was over. As a matter of fact, I did try for the Olympic team 1956.
Oh, you did?
These were the Australian Games and Melbourne Games. Mm-hmm. But I was, 32, I guess? Yeah. I turned 32 and just didn't have enough competition in between the lack of work and competition and the relatively advanced age of 32.
Yeah.
Just couldn't qualify, didn't qualify. And so, of course, I retired after that.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So was that a traumatic thing, retiring from track, which had been your life until then?
No, it wasn't.
No?
I knew it had to happen, going to come someday. And I had gone to 2 Olympic Games, which was you know, pretty good accomplishment in and of itself. And I had won gold medals in each one of them. And it just became apparent that my time was up. A fellow named Lee Calhoun had risen to the top of the rankings in the hurdles. Now, my chief competitor, Jack Davis, was still there.
Really?
In 1956.
Yeah.
And Jack had misfortune. in Melbourne to be beaten by Lee Calhoun.
Oh.
And his, I guess his race with Lee was maybe even closer than the one he had with me. But so he lost, in effect, two Olympic gold medals by less than 2-3 feet, I guess.
Oh, gee. Do you still have your gold medals?
Yeah, they're stored away.
Yeah.
Yeah, packed away.
How often do you bring them out, show them to people?
Seldom.
I should have asked you to bring them here today.
Yeah.
Oh. But so then you became a working guy the rest of your life.
Yeah, I had...
Did people treat you, by the way, well, a little differently knowing what you had accomplished?
I think those who have a real understanding of athletics and sport and the Olympic Games, there's maybe additional respect or something.
A little reverence. Might say, my God, you were a superstar.
That, the average person, that he won four Olympic gold medals. So what?
So you later worked for as the business manager of the Cleveland School Board.
Let's see. I stayed at the board. Not at the board, but I stayed with the Indians, as I said, through 1958. Then after that, I went into radio, WABQ radio, which is aimed at basically at the black.
Something just happened. I think this tape shut off. Did it? We're still doing okay? Okay.
Well, anyway, at WABQ, which was aimed primarily at the black audience, in fact, I helped put that station on the air.
You did?
Yeah. And when was that? Now I can't remember the year, but it had to be in the early 60s.
What was your role in putting it on the air?
I was program director.
You were?
Yeah. And I did a little news, sports, things like that. It was strictly a daytime station at that particular time. But I did that for several years.
Really?
And then finally in 1966, it had to be, I heard friends and I were discussing just things in general, and somebody said, I understand that there are openings down at the Cleveland Board of Education. They're hiring people for different, different things. So they want you to go down there and find out about it. So almost as a whim, I went down. And I went to this particular division, which is called the Manpower Training Division. It was situated in the old Mayflower Elementary School. Mayflower happened to be the first school that I ever attended.
No.
When I went to school, it was on just off of Orange Avenue on East 32nd Street. But anyway, this is where this Manpower Training headquarters was. This is a division of the Cleveland Board of Education. So I went there, and true, they were hiring people, and they asked my background. I had a degree in economics, a bachelor's, and of course I had done all this work with the baseball club, and had then the radio and television that I had done. So the head of that program, Lou Federico was his name. An odd thing, Lou had one brown eye, one blue eye.
No. Okay.
And so.
Funny thing, of all the things to remember.
Yeah. Lou hired me, and that's when I went to work for the Board of Education. I think it was 1966. And I stayed there in that program until 1971, when they called me downtown. Obviously, the people downtown knew who I was and my background. So an opening had developed downtown in the business manager's office. And when I went down there, I was hired to be in his office, in the business department, not directly in his office at that time, but in, what was it? I forgot now the title. But anyway, it was dealt with purchasing, director of purchasing, that's what it was. So I went down there in 71, I think. And I remained with the board until I retired in 1993. So I spent a total of 27 years with the Board of Education. The last 12 of that 27 years I spent as the head of the business department, chief of the business department. That is the department in the system that's responsible for everything that's non-academic, the buildings and the grounds, the purchasing, the contracts, all that.
Let me ask you this. You were there during the traumatic period of busing.
Yeah.
And what were your views on that?
I was ambivalent, I guess, sort of. I wanted children, yes, to obviously have the opportunity to attend schools that were better than the ones that, their neighborhood schools at that particular time. But at the same time, having to bus them from one side of town to the other, that was something that certainly was not favorable. I didn't like that that part of it. The busing, incidentally, fell under the aegis of the business department.
Really?
We had, when buses were purchased, that we were the department that you know, advertised, put the contracts out, and things like that, and ran the busing division of the business department.
It was expensive buying all those buses and everything, hiring bus drivers?
Millions of dollars.
Really? Wow. Were there, did you have to juggle some things to pay those bills?
No, the I guess the,
levies, the, money to,
the levies and the state and the federal government took care of the bulk of that.
Okay. Well, you've seen a lot of things in your life.
Yeah, I have.
But by the way, one last thing about the busing, looking back on it, was it good, bad, or neutral?
I guess, I'd, as I say, there's good and bad.
Yeah.
Overall, you'd... well, you give it a C, maybe.
Passing, oh, you want to grade it. Okay.
passing,
okay, professor.
passing grade, but not a, you know, nothing overwhelming. Again, as I said earlier, I certainly wanted the best for the kids in Cleveland.
Sure.
And so this was supposed to provide them with a chance to have a better education. And the other thing is, of course, is that the city has shrunk so much. When we were there, I think the school population now is around 40,000. When we were there, it was approaching 80,000, as I remember. So it's half of what it used to be, as well as the same with the city itself.
Yeah, that's right. So now what do you do? What I have seen you... out at summer track workouts. I think you had, did you have a, a grandson or a granddaughter on the...
I had a granddaughter. She lettered at Shaker in track. I have another one. The younger one is playing volleyball now at Richmond Heights. She's pretty good. She may wind up being the best athlete in the family.
Now, okay. Did your family, children, what about... how many children did you have?
One daughter, Terry.
Yes.
And... Terry had three children, my three grandchildren.
Okay.
My wife, Joy, passed after, 53 and a half years, I guess, we were married.
That was in about 2009,
she died. 2009, November,
just
the week before Thanksgiving.
So now looking back on your life, you're now here in the year 2012 when we're doing this. You're 89 years old. And looking back on a life of many accomplishments, how do you feel? Do you feel content? Have you, did you live up to your potential?
Well, certainly as an athlete I did, but there's a lot more to life, of course, than the sports and the athletics. And that, in my case, was over at the age of 32, and here I'm 89, so
yeah.
I've lived a lifetime since then. I don't know whose time I'm on at 89, but I think I'm using somebody else's time. But I think, in general, yes, I think I've been able to make a contribution.
Yes.
I still like to help kids whenever possible, so I still talk to them and attend the fairs for them. But over the years, I've been on the board with the YMCA, Lung Association, and speak to, you know, Kiwanis, Optimus, service groups, clubs, schools, church groups, all of that. So I'd like to think that I've made a contribution in the ensuing years following my retirement.
Yeah, the city is about half the size that it was in your heyday.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have any views on what's the future of Cleveland?
Oh, I think Cleveland's going to be okay.
Do you?
Yeah, I think as long as you have forward people, people with vision, and our current mayor seems to be one of those people.
That would be Frank Jackson.
Frank Jackson in his own way. The fact that, and hiring people like Boyd to run the board, I think they're headed in the right direction.
Okay, well, you've had a life well lived, and everybody in Cleveland is very proud of you, Harrison.
Thank you, Dave.
Harrison Dillard, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And I hope that my grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and the same with yours can listen to this someday and learn more about your life and the city of Cleveland.